For various reasons, I thought I'd like to share with you a story of Norman MacLean, M-A-C-L-E-A-N, only the first letter capitalized and no spaces. Norman MacLean. You may recall the name. You may have read his book, A River Runs Through It, and other stories, or his later nonfiction work, Young Men and Fire. You may have seen the movie adaptation of the title novella, A River Runs Through It, made by a gentleman named Redford, but that's really neither here nor there. Norman MacLean, born in 1902 in Clarinda, Iowa, grew up in Missoula, Montana, and spent most of his professional life and most of his physical life at the University of Chicago, where he was William Rainey Harper Professor of English until he retired at the age of 70 in 1973, and then in his 70s began to write. He was a teacher of English, but of reading, of Shakespeare, of poetry, of criticism, not of writing. And he was not a writer, was not producing books. He was a writer inside, though, and produced this book. He lived to 1990. I was privileged to know Norman in the early 1980s, to begin to know him, when he was in his early 80s. I want to read for you a story, the middle story. There are two novellas in the book, which was published in 1976 by the University of Chicago Press, and we'll come to that. A River Runs Through It, and USFS, or United States Forest Service, USFS 1919, The Ranger, the Cook, and A Hole in the Sky. And in between, there's a short story, but we'll come to that title in a moment as well. I want to read for you the acknowledgments. It's an interesting use of that term, an intentional one by Norman, for what is really more of a preface. And when I recommend this book and when I give this book to others, I do also want to point out you must go to the original version, which you can find in print or reprint. You don't want anybody else's epilogue. You don't want anybody else's photos. You don't want the other stories cut out. You want A River Runs Through It and other stories with Norman MacLean's acknowledgments. Although it's a little book, it took a lot of help to become a book at all. When one doesn't start out to be an author until he has reached his biblical allotment of 70 years and 10, he needs more than his own power. Then, to add further to their literary handicaps, these stories turned out to be Western stories. As one publisher said in returning them, "These stories have trees in them." It was my children, Jean and John, who started me off. They wanted me to put down in writing some of the stories I had told them when they were young. I don't want, though, to put the blame on my children for what resulted. As is known to any teller of stories who eventually tries to put a few of them down in writing, the act of writing changes them greatly. So none of these stories closely resembles any story I ever told my children. For one thing, writing makes everything bigger and longer. All these stories are much longer than is needed to achieve one of the primary ends of telling children stories, namely, that of putting children to sleep. However, the stories do give evidence of retaining another of those purposes, that of letting children know what kind of people their parents are, or think they are, or hope they are. Another problem soon arises after one gets help enough to start writing upon retirement. It arises from the fact that one can get started writing then only by not letting anyone know he has. He is so secret about it that even his own children don't know he has taken their advice. But being covert makes him suspicious of his own actions, and so he soon stands in need of some sort of public sanction. It was at this point that I accumulated my second round of debts. I had just finished my first story and was wondering what it was like and whether I should be allowed to go on when the secretary of a scholarly club I belonged to telephoned to tell me it was my turn to give the paper at the next monthly meeting. The club calls itself the Stochastics, the Thinkers, and originally they were all biologists who, however, in keeping with recent cultural changes, have taken in a certain number of humanists and social scientists. On the whole, the experiment has proved successful, since no distinction can be observed among these different social classes in the amount they drink before and during dinner and during the scientific and scholarly speeches that follow. Suddenly, I saw my chance to escape from creative claustrophobia. I said to the secretary, "I have just finished a paper I would be glad to read." The first story I wrote was the short one, based on a couple of summers I spent in logging camps. The secretary replied, "That's fine. Do you happen yet to have a title for it? You know, I have to send out the title along with the speaker on the postcard announcing the meeting." In the process of creating this story, then, I have had at least one inspired moment, because in a flash I answered, "On the postcard where it says title, put down logging and pimping. And where it says speaker, put down Norman McLean, noted authority." Finally, I could hear breathing over the telephone, so to aid in the process of resuscitation, I added, "It's a scholarly work, as scholars say, a genuine contribution to knowledge." Afterwards, the secretary told me the attendance at the meeting was the largest in the records of the society. However, I was left in some doubt whether this scholarly reception was for the story or the title. Nevertheless, I was invited back for a repeat performance the following autumn, when the Stochastics have what they call their, quote, heterosexual meeting, and the wives are invited. By this time, I had almost finished the story USFS 1919. In the spirit of the occasion, I read them the section that has a woman in it, even though she happens to be a whore. She and I were so well received by the faculty wives that I didn't need any more moral support until I was nearly finished with the book. In retirement, the realization comes late that getting a book published, all the way published, is a major step in the act of creation. Unless one has friends left at the end of life, this realization may come too late. To make a very long story short, I will connect it back to the Stochastics, only in this case to individual members who had written enough books when they were young to realize that I shouldn't be left wandering around unprotected and alone at this moment of life. I wish to thank especially David Bevington, Wayne Booth, John Coelty, Dr. Jarl Dyrud, Gwyn Kolb, Kenneth Northcott, and Edward Rosenheim. I am sure that without them, what I would have now would be some handwritten children's stories too long to tell children. The University of Chicago Press is proud of its tradition of never allowing its authors to thank any of its staff by name. I respect this tradition, but some members of the press had to be sufficiently interested in these stories to seek and obtain permission to publish a work of original fiction for the first time in its long history. I would be emotionally numb if I did not appreciate such an honor. Perhaps I can find other ways of letting them know, if I may use an old Western phrase, that I am forever grateful to them. I accumulated still another set of debts soon after the University Press and its board agreed to publish its first book of fiction. It's primarily fiction, all right, but most children's stories have a fairly obvious secondary intention of instruction, and these stories are no exception. Children, much more than adults, like to know how things were before they were born, especially in parts of the world that now seem strange or have even disappeared, but were once lived in by their parents. So I acquired the habit long ago of slipping in pictures of how men and horses did things in western parts of the world, where often the main thoroughfares were game trails. Moreover, it was always important to me to lead my children into real woods, not the woods of Little Red Riding Hood. To me, the constant wonder has been how strange reality has been. So a time came in creation when my thinking took a classical, critical turn, and I remembered that Socrates said, if you paint a picture of a table, you have to call in expert carpenters to know whether you have done well. The following are the chief experts I consulted to find out how well I had painted the land I love and fly fishing and the logging camps and forest service I had worked in when I was young. For their sensitive and expert reading of A River Runs Through It, I was indebted to Jean and John Baucus, owners of the Great Zeebin Sheep Ranch, which runs from the Helena Valley to Wolf Creek to the Big Blackfoot River, a triangle of the earth that contains a great deal of my life and several of my stories. For expert opinion on my story about the Bitterroots and my early years in the Forest Service, I turned to W.R. Bud Moore, Chief of Fire Management and Air Operations in the United States Forest Service. As a woodsman, he is a legend in our mountain land and is made of such stuff as honorary doctoral degrees, although he never went beyond grade school. When he was in his early teens, he spent his winters running a trap line across the Bitterroot Divide, where I started working for the Forest Service. In the winters, now that he is retired from the service, he spends 2 days of a week that's crowded with writing, teaching, and research in running a trap line from Rock Creek across the Sapphire Mountains to the Bitterroot Valley. I advise none of my young readers to try to follow him on snowshoes across this desperate stretch of country. I am also indebted to three expert women of the Forest Service for giving me a helping hand while I was writing these stories. Beverly Ayers, archivist of photographs, and Sarah Heath and Joyce Haley, cartographic technicians. They are absolutely first rate and have the added gift of always knowing what it is I am looking for, even when I don't. I turned the story about my brother and fly fishing over to George Kroonenbergs, who tied flies for my brother and me over 40 years ago, and David Roberts, who has lived a long life fishing and hunting and writing about them 3 or 4 times a week. They are the two finest fly fishermen I know. They also bring to mind an indebtedness of another time and order. They and I are indebted to my father for our love of fly fishing. George Kroonenbergs received his first lessons in fly tying from him, and David Roberts still writes an occasional column about him. As for me, all my stories can be thought of as partial acknowledgments of my indebtedness to him. Perhaps it is a question to you why I needed the great expert on the Cheyenne Indians, Father Peter Powell, to read my stories, when only one Cheyenne Indian appears in them and she is not of full blood. I needed this great and good man in his most pristine calling to assure me there are still moments in my memories that are touched with the life of the spirit. Finally, I have published practically nothing that has not profited from the criticisms, which she calls suggestions, of Marie Borof, first woman full professor in English at Yale. If you think I am wasting a lady's time in asking her to read stories about logging camps and the Forest Service as they were half a century ago, then I probably will have to tell you the kind of thing she tells me. Before I give you an example, though, perhaps I should add that she is also a poet. Of my first story, the one about logging, she said, among other things, I was concentrating so on telling a story that I didn't take time to be a poet and express a little of the love I have of the earth as it goes by. Compare now the two long stories I wrote after she told me this with my first story, which is short, and you should get some notion of how carefully I listen to the lady from Yale. This, then, in summary, is a collection of Western stories with trees in them, for children, experts, scholars, wives of scholars, and scholars who are poets. I hope there are others also who don't mind trees. Logging and Pimping, and Your Pal, Jim, by Norman MacLean. The first time I took any real notice of him was on a Sunday afternoon in a bunkhouse in one of the Anaconda Company's logging camps on the Blackfoot River. He and I and some others had been lying on our bunks reading, although it was warm and half dark in the bunkhouse this summer afternoon. The rest of them had been talking, but to me, everything seemed quiet. As events proved in a few minutes, the talking had been about the company, and probably the reason I hadn't heard it was that the lumberjacks were registering their customary complaints about the company. It owned them body and soul. It owned the state of Montana, the press, the preachers, etc. The grub was lousy, and likewise the wages, which the company took right back from them anyway by overpricing everything at the commissary. And they had to buy from the commissary out in the woods. Where else could they buy? It must have been something like this they were saying, because all of a sudden I heard him break the quiet. "Shut up, you incompetent sons of bitches! If it weren't for the company, you'd all starve to death." At first I wasn't sure I had heard it or he had said it, but he had. Everything was really quiet now, and everybody was watching his small face and big head and body behind an elbow on his bunk. After a while there were stirrings, and one by one the stirrings disappeared into the sunlight of the door. Not a stirring spoke, and this was a logging camp, and they were big men. Lying there on my bunk, I realized that actually this was not the first time I had noticed him. For instance, I already knew his name, which was Jim Grierson, and I knew he was a socialist who thought Eugene Debs was soft. Probably he hated the company more than any man in camp, but the men he hated more than the company. It was also clear I had noticed him before, because when I started to wonder how I would come out with him in a fight, I discovered I already had the answer. I estimated he weighed 185 to 190 pounds, so was at least 35 pounds heavier than I was. But I figured I had been better taught and could reduce him to size if I could last the first 10 minutes. I also figured that probably I could not last the first 10 minutes. I didn't go back to my reading, but lay there looking for something interesting to think about, and was interested finally in realizing that I had estimated my chances with Jim in a fight even before I thought I had noticed him. Almost from the first moment I saw Jim, I must have felt threatened, and others obviously felt the same way. Later, as I came to know him better, all my thinking about him was colored by the question, him or me? He had just taken over the bunkhouse, except for me, and now he was tossing on his bunk to indicate his discomfort at my presence. I stuck it out for a while just to establish homestead rights to existence, but now that I couldn't read anymore, the bunkhouse seemed hotter than ever, so after carefully measuring the implications of my not being wanted, I got up and sauntered out the door as he rolled over and sighed. By the end of the summer, when I had to go back to school, I knew a lot more about Jim, and in fact, he and I had made a deal to be partners for the coming summer. It didn't take long to find out that he was the best lumberjack in camp. He was probably the best with the saw and axe, and he worked with a kind of speed that was part ferocity. This was back in 1927, as I remember. And of course, there was no such thing as a chainsaw then, just as now there is no such thing as a logging camp or a bunkhouse the whole length of the Blackfoot River, although there is still a lot of logging going on there. Now the saws are one-man chainsaws run by light, high-speed motors, and the sawyers are married and live with their families, some of them as far away as Missoula, and drive more than 100 miles a day to get to and from work. But in the days of the logging camps, the men worked mostly on two-man crosscut saws that were things of beauty, and the highest-paid man in camp was the man who delicately filed and set them. The two-man teams who pulled the saws either worked for wages or gypoed. To gypo, which wasn't meant to be a nice-sounding word and could be used as either a noun or a verb, was to be paid by the number of thousands of board feet you cut a day. Naturally, you chose to gypo only if you thought you could beat wages and the men who worked for wages. As I said, Jim had talked me into being his partner for next summer, and we were going to gypo and make big money. You can bet I agreed to this with some misgivings, but I was in graduate school now and on my own financially and needed the big money. Besides, I suppose, I was flattered by being asked to be the partner of the best sawyer in camp. It was a long way, though, from being all flattery. I also knew I was being challenged. This was the world of the woods and the working stiff, the logging camp being a world especially overbearing with challenges. And if you expected to duck all challenges, you shouldn't have wandered into the woods in the first place. It is true, too, that up to a point, I liked being around him. He was 3 years older than I was, which at times is a lot, and he had seen parts of life with which I, as the son of a Presbyterian minister, wasn't exactly intimate. A couple of other things cropped up about him that summer that had a bearing on the next summer when he and I were to gypo together. He told me he was Scotch, which figured, and that made two of us. He said that he had been brought up in the Dakotas and that his father, and I quote, was a Scotch son of a bitch who threw him out of the house when he was 14, and he had been making his own living ever since. He explained to me that he made his living only partly by working. He worked just in the summer, and then this cultural side of him, as it were, took over. He holed up for the winter in some town that had a good Carnegie Public Library, and the first thing he did was take out a library card. Then he went looking for a good whore, and so he spent the winter reading and pimping, or maybe this is stated in reverse order. He said that on the whole, he preferred Southern whores. Southern whores, he said, were generally, quote, more poetical. And later, I think I came to know what he meant by this. So I started graduate school that autumn, and it was tough, and not made any easier by the thought of spending all next summer on the end of a saw opposite this direct descendant of a Scotch son of a bitch. But finally, it was late June, and there he was, sitting on a log across from me and looking as near like $1 million as a lumberjack can look. He was dressed all in wool, in a rich black watch plaid shirt, gray short-legged stag pants, and a beautiful new pair of logging boots with an inch or so of white sock showing at the top. The lumberjack and the cowboy followed many of the same basic economic and ecological patterns. They achieved a balance if they were broke at the end of the year. If they were lucky and hadn't been sick or anything like that, they had made enough to get drunk 3 or 4 times and to buy their clothes. Their clothes were very expensive. They claimed they were robbed up and down the line, and probably they were, but clothes that would stand their work and the weather had to be something special. Central to both the lumberjack's and the cowboy's outfit were the boots, which took several months of savings. The pair that Jim had on were white loggers, made, as I remember, by a company in Spokane that kept your name and measurements. It was a great shoe. But there were others, and they were great, too. They had to be. The Bass, the Bergman, and the Chippewa were all made in different parts of the country. But in the Northwest, most of the jacks I remember wore the Spokane shoe. As the cowboy boot was made always for riding horses and working steers, the logger's boot was made for working on and around logs. Jim's pair had a 6-inch top, but there were models with much higher tops. Jim happened to belong to the school that wanted their ankles supported, but no tie on their legs. The toe was capless and made soft and somewhat waterproof with neat's foot oil. The shoe was shaped to walk or ride logs. It had a high instep to fit the log, and with a high instep went a high heel, not nearly so high as a cowboy's and much sturdier, because these were walking shoes. In fact, very fine walking shoes. The somewhat high heel threw you slightly forward of your normal stance and made you feel you were being helped ahead. Actually, this feeling was their trademark. Jim was sitting with his right leg rocking on his left knee, and he gestured a good deal with his foot, raking the log I was sitting on for emphasis and leaving behind a gash in its side. The soles of these loggers' boots looked like World War I, with trenches and barbed wire highly planned, everything planned in this case for riding logs and walking. Central to the grand design were the caulks, or corks, as the Jacks called them. They were long and sharp enough to hold to a heavily barked log, or tougher still, to one that was dead and had no bark on it. But of course, caulks would have ripped out at the edges of a shoe and made you stumble and trip at the toes. So the design started with a row of blunt, sturdy hobnails around the edges, and maybe four or five rows of them at the toes. Then inside came the battlefield of caulks, the real barbed wire, with two rows of caulks coming down each side of the sole and one row on each side continuing into the instep to hold you when you jumped crosswise on a log. Actually, it was a beautiful, if somewhat primitive, design and had many uses. For instance, when a couple of Jacks got into a fight and one went down, the other was almost sure to kick and rake him with his boots. This treatment was known as giving him the leather, and when a Jack got this treatment, he was out of business for a long time and was never very pretty again. Every time Jim kicked and raked the big log beside me for emphasis, I wiped small pieces of bark off my face. In this brief interlude in our relations, it seemed to me that his face had grown a great deal since I first knew him last year. From last year, I remembered big frame, big head, small face, tight like a fist. I even wondered at times if it wasn't his best punch. But sitting here relaxed and telling me about pimping and spraying bark on my face, he looked all big, his nose too and eyes, and he looked handsome. And clearly he liked pimping, at least for 4 or 5 months of the year, and he especially liked being bouncer in his own establishment. But even that, he said, got boring. It was good to be out in the woods again, he said, and it was good to see me, he also said that, and it was good to be back to work, he said that several times. Most of this took place in the first 3 or 4 days. We started in easy, each one admitting to the other that he was soft from the winter. And besides, Jim hadn't finished giving me this course on pimping. Pimping is a little more complicated than the innocent bystander might think. Besides selecting a whore, big as well as southern, i.e. poetical, and keeping her happy, taking her to the Bijou Theater in the afternoons, and hustling, rounding up all the Swedes and Finns and French Canadians you had known in the woods, you also had to be your own bootlegger, it still being prohibition, and your own police fixer, it being then as always, and your own bouncer, which introduced a kind of sporting element into the game. But after a few days of resting every hour, we had pretty well covered the subject, and still nobody seemed interested in bringing up socialism. I suppose that an early stage in coming to hate someone is just running out of things to talk about. I thought then it didn't make a damn bit of difference to me that he liked his whores big as well as southern. Besides, we were getting in shape a little. We started skipping the rest periods and took only half an hour at lunch, and at lunch we sharpened our axes on our carborundum stones. Slowly, we became silent, and silence itself is an enemy to friendship. When we came back to camp, each went his own way, and within a week, we weren't speaking to each other. Well, this in itself needn't have been ominous. Lots of teams of Sawyers work in silence, because that is pretty much the kind of guys they are, and of course, because no one can talk and at the same time turn out thousands of board feet. Some teams of Sawyers even hate each other and yet work together year after year, something like the old New York Celtic basketball team, knowing the other guy's moves without troubling to look. But our silence was different. It didn't have much to do with efficiency and big production. When he broke the silence to ask me if I would like to change from a 6 to a 7-foot saw, I knew I was sawing for survival. A 6-foot blade was plenty long enough for the stuff we were sawing, and the extra foot would have been only that much more for me to pull. It was getting hot, and I was half sick when I came back to camp at the end of the day. I would dig into my duffel bag and get clean underwear and clean white socks and a bar of soap and go to the creek. Afterwards, I would sit on the bank until I was dry. Then I would feel better. It was a rule I had learned my first year working in the Forest Service. When exhausted and feeling sorry for yourself, at least change socks. On weekends, I spent a lot of time washing my clothes. I washed them carefully, and I expected them to be white, not gray, when they had dried on the brush. At first, then, I relied on small home remedies, such as cleanliness. I had a period, too, when I leaned on proverbs and tried to pass the blame back on myself with some justification. All winter, I had had a fair notion that something like this would happen. Now I would try to be philosophical by saying to myself, "Well, pal, if you fool around with the bull, you have to expect the horn." But when you are gored, there is not much comfort in proverbs. Gradually, though, I began to fade out of my own picture of myself and what was happening, and it was he who controlled my thoughts. In these dreams, some of which I had during the day, I was always pulling a saw, and he was always at the other end of it, getting bigger and bigger, but his face getting smaller and smaller and closer, until finally it must have come through the cut in the log, and with no log between us now, it threatened to continue on down the saw until it ran into me. It sometimes came close enough so that I could see how it got smaller by twisting and contracting itself around its nose, and somewhere along here in my dream I would wake up from the exertion of trying to back away from what I was dreaming about. In a later stage of my exhaustion, there was no dream or sleep, just a constant awareness of being thirsty and of a succession of events of such a low biological order that normally they escaped notice. All night sighs succeeded grunts and grumblings of the guts, and about an hour after everyone was in bed and presumably asleep, there were attempts at homosexuality, usually unsuccessful if the statistics I started to keep were at all representative. The bunkhouse would become almost silent. Suddenly, somebody would jump up in his bed, punch another somebody, and mutter, "You filthy son of a bitch!" Then he would punch him 4 or 5 times more, fast, hard punches. The other somebody never punched back. Instead, trying to be silent, his grieved footsteps returned to bed. It was still early in the night, too early to start thinking about daybreak. You lay there quietly through the hours, feeling as if you had spent all the previous day drinking out of a galvanized pail. Eventually, every thought of water tasted galvanized. After 2 or 3 nights of this, you came to know you could not be whipped. Probably you could not win, but you could not be whipped. I'll try not to get technical about logging, but I have to give you some idea of daylight reality and some notion of what was going on in the woods while I was trying to stay alive. Jim's pace was set to kill me off. It would kill him eventually, too, but first me. So the problem, broadly speaking, was how to throw him off this pace and not quite get caught doing it. Because after working a week with this Jack Dempsey at the other end of the saw, I knew I'd never have a chance if he took a punch at me. Yet I would have taken a punching from him before I would ever have asked him to go easier on the saw. You were no logger if you didn't feel this way. The world of the woods and the working stiff was pretty much made of 3 things: working, fighting, and dames. And the complete lumberjack had to be handy at all of them. But if it came to the bitter choice, he could not remain a logger and be outworked. If I had ever asked for mercy on the saw, I might as well have packed my duffel bag and started down the road. So I tried to throw Jim off pace even before we began a cut. Often, before beginning to saw, sawyers have to do a certain amount of brushing out, which means taking an axe and chopping bushes or small jack pines that would interfere with the sawing. I guess that by nature I did more of this than Jim, and now I did as much of it as I dared, and it burned hell out of him, especially since he had yelled at me about it early in the season when we were still speaking to each other. Jesus, he had said, you're no gippo. Anytime a guy's not sawing, he's not making money. Nobody out here is paying you for trimming a garden. He would walk up to a cut, and if there was a small jack pine in the way, he would bend it over and hold it with his foot while he sawed and he ripped through the huckleberry bushes. He didn't give a damn if the bushes clogged his saw. He just pulled harder. As to the big thing, sawing, it is something beautiful when you are working rhythmically together. At times you forget what you were doing and get lost in abstraction of motion and power. But when sawing isn't rhythmical, even for a short time, it becomes a kind of mental illness, maybe even something more deeply disturbing than that. It is as if your heart isn't working right. Jim, of course, had thrown us off basic rhythm when he started to saw me into the ground by making the stroke too fast and too long, even for himself. Most of the time, I followed his stroke. I had to. But I would pick periods when I would not pull the saw to me at quite the speed or distance he was pulling it back to him. Just staying slightly off beat, not being quite so noticeable that he could yell, but still letting him know what I was doing. To make sure he knew, I would suddenly go back to his stroke. I'll mention just one more trick I invented with the hope of weakening Jim by frequent losses of adrenaline. Sawyers have many little but nevertheless almost sacred rules of work in order to function as a team, and every now and then I would almost break one of these, but not quite. For instance, if you are making a cut in a fallen tree and it binds or pinches and you need a wedge to open the cut and free your saw and the wedge is on Jim's side of the log, then you are not supposed to reach over the log and get the wedge and do the job. Among sawyers, no time is wasted doing Alphonse Gaston acts. What is on your side is your job. That's the rule. But every now and then, I would reach over for his wedge, and when our noses almost bumped, he would freeze and glare. It was like a close-up in an early movie. Finally, I'd look somewhere else, as if of all things I had never thought of the wedge, and you can be sure that, though I reached for it, I never got to it first and touched it. Most of the time, I took a lot of comfort from the feeling that some of this was getting to him. Admittedly, there were times when I wondered if I weren't making up a good part of this feeling just to comfort myself. But even then, I kept doing things that in my mind were hostile acts. The other lumberjacks, though, helped to make me feel that I was real. They all acknowledged I was in a big fight, and quietly they encouraged me, probably with the hope they wouldn't have to take him on themselves. One of them muttered to me as we started out in the morning, "Someday that son of a bitch go out in the woods. He no come back." By which I assumed he meant I was to drop a tree on him and forget to yell, "Timber!" Actually, though, I had already thought of this. Another good objective sign was that he got in a big argument with the head cook, demanding pie for breakfast. It sounds crazy, for anybody who knows anything knows that the head cook runs the logging camp. He is, as the jacks say, the guy with the golden testicles. If he doesn't like a jack because the jack has the bad table manners to talk at mealtime, the cook goes to the woods foreman and the jack goes down the road. Just the same, Jim got all the men behind him and then put up his big argument, and nobody went down the road, and we had pie every morning for breakfast, two or three kinds, and nobody ever ate a piece. Nobody, including Jim. Oddly, after Jim won this pie fight with the cook, things got a little better for me in the woods. We still didn't speak to each other, but we did start sawing in rhythm. Then one Sunday afternoon, this woman rode into camp and stopped to talk with the woods foreman and his wife. She was a big woman on a horse and carried a pail. Nearly everyone in camp knew her or of her. She was the wife of a rancher who owned one of the finest ranches in the valley. I had only met her, but my family knew her family quite well, my father occasionally coming up the valley to preach to the especially congregated Presbyterians. Anyway, I thought I had better go over and speak to her and maybe do my father's cause some good, but it was a mistake. She was still sitting on her big horse, and I had talked to her for just a couple of minutes when who shows up at gym and without looking at me says he is my partner and pal and asks her about the pail, the woods foreman takes all our parts in reply. First he answers for her and says she is out to pick huckleberries, and then he speaks as foreman and tells her we are sawyers and know the woods well, and then he replies to himself and speaks for us and assures her that Jim would be glad to show her where the huckleberries are, and it's a cinch he was. In the camp, the men were making verbal bets, where nothing changes hands, that Jim laid her within 2 hours. One of the jacks said, he's as fast with dames as with logs. By late afternoon, she rode back into camp. She never stopped. She was hurried and at a distance looked white and didn't have any huckleberries. She didn't even have her empty pail. Who the hell knows what she told her husband? At first, I felt kind of sorry for her because she was so well known in camp and was so much talked about. But she was riding high, wide, and handsome. She was back in camp every Sunday. She always came with a gallon pail, and she always left without it. She kept coming long after huckleberry season passed. There wasn't a berry left on a bush, but she came with another big pail. The pie fight with the cook and the empty huckleberry pail were just what I needed psychologically to last until Labor Day weekend, when, long ago, I had told both Jim and the foreman I was quitting in order to get ready for school. There was no great transformation in either Jim or me. Jim was still about the size of Jack Dempsey. Nothing had happened to reduce this combination of power and speed. It was just that something had happened so that most of the time now we sawed to saw logs. And for me, for the first and only time in my life, I had spent over a month, 24 hours a day, doing nothing but hating a guy. Now, though, there were times when I thought it over. It got so that I had to say to myself, don't ever, ever forget to hate this guy for trying to kill you off. It was somewhere along in here, too, when I became confident enough to develop the theory that he wouldn't take a punch at me. I probably was just getting wise to the fact that he ran this camp as if he were the best fighter in it without ever getting into a fight. He had us stiffs intimidated, because he made us look bad when it came to work and women, and so we went on to feel that we were also about to take a punching. Fortunately, I guess, I always realized this might be just theory, and I continued to act as if he were the best fighter in camp, as he probably was, but you know, it still bothers me that maybe he wasn't. When we quit work at night, though, we still walked to camp alone. He still went first, slipping on his Woolrich shirt over the top piece of his underwear, and putting his empty lunch pail under his arm. Like all sawyers, we pulled off our shirts first thing in the morning and worked all day in the tops of our underwear. And in the summer, we still wore wool underwear because we said sweat made cotton stick to us, and wool absorbed it. After Jim disappeared for camp, I sat on a log and waited for the sweat to dry. It still took me a while before I felt steady enough to reach for my Woolrich shirt and pick up my lunch pail and head for camp. But now I knew I could last until I had said I would quit, which sometimes can be a wonderful feeling. One day toward the end of August, he spoke out of the silence and said, "When are you going to quit?" It sounded as if someone had broken the silence before it was broken by Genesis. I answered, and fortunately I had an already made answer. I said, "As I told you, the Labor Day weekend." He said, "I may see you in town before you leave for the East. I'm going to quit early this year myself." Then he added, "Last spring I promised a dame I would." I and all the other jacks had already noticed that the ranger's wife hadn't shown up in camp last Sunday, whatever that meant. The week before I was going to go back to school, I ran into him on the main street. He looked great, a little thin, but just a little. He took me into a speakeasy and brought me a drink of Canadian Club. Since Montana is a northern border state, during Prohibition, there was a lot of Canadian whiskey in my town, if you knew where and had the price. I bought the second round, and he bought another and said he had enough when I tried to do the same. Then he added, "You know, I have to take care of you." Even after three drinks in the afternoon, I was a little startled, and still am. Outside, as we stood parting and squinting in the sunlight, he said, "I got a place all ready for this dame of mine, but we've not yet set up for business." Then he said very formally, "We would appreciate it very much if you would pay us a short visit before you leave town." And he gave me the address, and when I told him it would have to be soon, we made a date for the next evening. The address he had given me was on the north side, which is just across the tracks where most of the railroaders lived. When I was a kid, our town had what was called a red light district on Front Street, adjoining the city dump, which was always burning with a fitting smell. But the law had more or less closed it up and scattered the girls around, a fair proportion of whom sprinkled themselves among the railroaders. When I finally found the exact address, I recognized the house next to it. It belonged to a brakeman who married a tramp and thought he was quite a fighter, although he never won many fights. He was more famous in town for the story that he came home one night unexpectedly and captured a guy coming out. He reached in his pocket and pulled out $3. "Here," he told the guy, "go and get yourself a good screw." Jim's place looked on the up and up, no shades drawn, and the door slightly open and streaming light. Jim answered and was big enough to blot out most of the scenery, but I could see the edge of his dame just behind him. I remembered she was supposed to be Southern and could see curls on her one visible shoulder. Jim was talking and never introduced us. Suddenly, she swept around and grabbed me by the hand and said, "God bless you, old pee-hole. Come on in and park your old prat on the piano." Suddenly, I think I understood what Jim had meant when he told me early in the summer that he liked his horse Southern because they were poetical. I took a quick look around the parlor, and sure enough, there was no piano. So it was pure poetry. Later, when I found out her name, it was Annabelle, which fitted. After this exuberant outcry, she backed off in silence and sat down, it being evident, as she passed the light from a standing lamp, that she had no clothes on under her dress. When I glanced around the parlor and did not see a piano, I did, however, notice another woman and the motto of Scotland. The other woman looked older, but not so old as she was supposed to be, because when she finally was introduced, she was introduced as Annabelle's mother. Naturally, I wondered how she figured in Jim's operation, and a few days later I ran into some jacks in town who knew her and said she was still a pretty good whore, although a little sad and flabby. Later that evening I tried talking to her. I don't think there was much left to her inside, but it was clear she thought the world of Jim. I had to take another look to believe it, but there it was on the wall, just above the chair Jim was about to sit in, the motto of Scotland, and in Latin, too, "Nemo me impune lacessit." Supposedly, only Jim would know what it meant. The whores wouldn't know, and it's for sure his trade, who were Scandinavian and French-Canadian lumberjacks, wouldn't. So he sat on his leather throne, owner and chief bouncer of the establishment, believing only he knew that over his head it said, "No one will touch me with impunity." But there was one exception. I knew what it meant, having been brought up under the same plaque, in fact, an even tougher-looking version that had Scotch thistles engraved around the motto. My father had it hung in the front hall, where it would be the first thing seen at all times by anyone entering the manse. And in the early mornings on her way to the kitchen, by my mother, who inherited the unmentioned infirmity of being part English. Jim did most of the talking, and the rest of us listened, and sometimes I just watched. He sure as hell was a good-looking guy, and now he was all dressed up, conservatively, in a dark gray herringbone suit and a blue or black tie. But no matter the clothes, he always looked like a lumberjack to me. Why not? He was the best logger I ever worked with, and I barely lived to say so. Jim talked mostly about saving and college. He and I had talked about almost nothing during the summer, least of all about college. Now he asked me a lot of questions about college, but it just wasn't the case that they were asked out of envy or regret. He didn't look at me as a Scotch boy like himself, not so good with the axe and saw, but luckier. He looked at himself, at least as he sat there that night, as a successful young businessman, and he certainly didn't think I was ever going to do anything that he wanted to do. What his being a socialist meant to him, I was never to figure out. To me, he emerged as all laissez-faire. He was one of those people who turn out not to have some characteristic that you thought was a prominent one when you first met them. Maybe you only thought they had it because what you first saw or heard was at acute angle. Or maybe they have it in some form, but your personality makes it recessive. Anyway, he and I never talked politics, admitting that most of the time we never talked at all. I heard him talking socialism to the other Jacks. Yelling it at them would be more exact, as if they didn't know how to saw. Coming out the back door of the Dakotas in the 20s, he had to be a dispossessed socialist of some sort. But his talk to me about graduate school was concerned mostly with the question of whether, if hypothetically he decided to take it on, he could reduce graduate study to sawdust, certainly a fundamental capitalistic question. His educational experience in the Dakotas had had a lasting effect. He had gone as far as the 7th grade, and his teachers in the Dakotas had been big and tough and had licked him. What he was wondering was whether between 7th grade and graduate school, the teachers kept pace with their students and could still lick him. I cheered him up a lot when I told him, no, last winter wasn't as tough as this summer. He bought us all another drink of Canadian Club, and while drinking this one, it occurred to me that maybe what he had been doing this summer was giving me his version of graduate school. If so, he wasn't far wrong. Nearly all our talk, though, was about logging, because logging was what loggers talked about. They mixed it into everything. For instance, loggers celebrated the 4th of July, the only sacred holiday in those times except Christmas, by contests in log rolling, sawing, and swinging the axe. Their work was their world, which included their games and their women, and the women at least had to talk like loggers, especially when they swore. Annabelle would occasionally come up with such a line as, "Somebody ought to drop the boom on that bastard." But when I started fooling around to find out whether she knew what a boom was, she switched back to pure Southern poetry. A whore has to swear like her working men, and in addition, she has to have pretty talk. I was interested, too, in the way Jim pictured himself and me to his women, always as friendly, working partners, talking over some technical sawing problem. In his creations, we engaged in such technical dialogue as this. "How much are you holding there?" I'd ask. "I'm holding 1.5 inches, he'd say, and I'd say, "God, I'm holding 2.5 inches. I can tell you that outside of the first few days of the summer, we didn't engage in any such friendly talk, and any sawyer can tell you that the technical stuff he had us saying about sawing may sound impressive to whores, but doesn't make any sense to sawyers and had to be invented by him. He was a great sawyer and didn't need to make up anything, but it seemed as if every time he made us friends, he had to make up lies about sawing to go with us. I wanted to talk a little to the women before I left, but when I turned to Annabelle, she almost finished me off before I got started by saying, "So you and I are partners of Jim?" Seeing that she had made such a big start with this, she was off in another minute trying to persuade me she was Scotch, but I told her, "Try that on some Swede." Her style was to be everything you wish she were, except what you knew she wasn't. I didn't have to listen long before I was fairly sure she wasn't Southern. Neither was the other one. They said "you all" and "ole" and had curls, and that was about it, all of which they probably did for Jim from the Dakotas. Every now and then, Annabelle would become slightly hysterical, at least suddenly exuberant, and speak a line of something like poetry, an alliterative toast or rune or foreign expression. Then she would go back to her quiet game of trying to figure out something besides Scotch that she might persuade me she was, that I would like but wouldn't know much about. Earlier in the evening, I realized that the two women were not mother and daughter or related in any way. Probably all three of them got strange pleasures from the notion they were a family. Both women, of course, dressed alike and had curls and did the Southern bit. But fundamentally, they were not alike in bone or body structure, except that they were both big women. So all three of them created a warm family circle of lies. The lumberjack in Herringbone and his two big women in only dresses blocked the door as we said goodbye. "So long," I said from the outside. "Au revoir," Annabelle said. "So long," Jim said. And then he added, "I'll be writing you." And he did. But not until later in autumn. By then, probably all the Swedish and Finnish loggers knew his Northside place, and he had drawn out his card from the Missoula Public Library and was rereading Jack London, omitting the dog stories. Since my address on the envelope was exact, he must have called my home to get it. The envelope was large and square. The paper was small, ruled, and had glue on the top edge, so it was pulled off some writing pad. His handwriting was large, but grew smaller at the end of each word. I received 3 other letters from him before the school year was out. His letters were only a sentence or two long. The 1 or 2 sentence literary form, when used by a master, is designed not to pass on some slight matter, but to put the world in a nutshell. Jim was my first acquaintance with the master of this form. His letters always began, "Dear partner," and always ended, "Your pal, Jim." You can be sure I ignored any shadow of suggestion that I work with him the coming summer, and he never openly made the suggestion. I decided that I had only a part of my life to give to gypoing, and that I had already given generously. I went back to the United States Forest Service and fought fires, which to Jim was like declaring myself a charity case and taking the rest cure. So naturally, I didn't hear from him that summer. Undoubtedly, he had some other sawyer at the end of the saw whom he was reducing to sawdust. But come autumn, and there was a big square envelope with the big handwriting that grew smaller at the end of each word. Since it was early autumn, he couldn't have been set up in business yet. Probably he had just quit the woods and was in town still looking things over. It could be he hadn't even drawn a library card yet. Anyway, this was the letter. "Dear partner, just to let you know, I have screwed a dame that weighs 300 pounds. Your pal, Jim." A good many years have passed since I received that letter, and I have never heard from or about Jim since. Maybe at 300 pounds, the son of a bitch was finally overpowered. Logging and Pimping and Your Pal, Jim, a story from the 1970s by Norman MacLean. Another side of Norman MacLean, from his A River Runs Through It and other stories. And I hope you recall, too, that wonderful prefatory essay, Acknowledgments, on what it means to write and what it means to be. I'd like to thank Matt DeStefano, who puts up with me at the other end of the saw. We each try to reduce each other to sawdust, but we usually speak to each other as well. I'd like to thank our funders, Alphawood Foundation, Dick and Susie Kiphart, and other friends of this program. Let us know what you thought about this or any of our other programs. Drop us a line. Rentap, it's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com, or click on the Chime In feature at WFMT.com and at WFMT.com/Critical Thinking. You can load up on the always free Critical Thinking podcast with these programs, Critics' Choices, maybe even more. I'm Andrew Patner. We're off for the next 2 weeks, Christmas Eve, New Year's Eve, but we'll see you the first Monday in January.